check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Let's go!
It's the most all-star studded challenge ever. And this time, it's every competitor for themselves.
Best challenge ever!
The Challenge All-Stars. New season now streaming on Paramount Plus. Go to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Terms apply.
Hey y'all, it's Bud. I wanted to thank you for making Barton and Bud such a success. With your listenership, we became one of the most popular college football shows in only 8 months. But with Barton gone, we have a lot of holes to fill as a company. One of those is on the Cover 3 podcast. And I'm happy to let you know that I'll be bringing my analysis to the Cover 3 podcast, both in regular appearances and in helping to set the table behind the scenes. We'll also be taking some of your Barton and Bud mailbag questions on Cover 3 since Apple finally updated its review section. We'll be dropping some Cover 3 episodes into this feed for a while, so you can get the feel for it. But please do subscribe to Cover 3 now, because at some point in the future, this feed might get repurposed. Thanks again, guys, and I hope you enjoyed the episode.
Welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast with your hosts, Danny Cannell, Chip Patterson, Barton Simmons, and Tom Fornelli. It's your call for the best college football coverage from National Signing Day to the National Championship and everything in between. CBS Sports presents the Cover 3 Podcast.
And welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast here on CBS Sports. That's Bud Elliott. That's Tom Fornelli. That's Bill Connolly. We are very, very excited to have Bill Connolly from ESPN here. First of all, a return visit for you, Bill. So welcome back here on the Cover 3 Podcast. You joined Barton and I. It is a reunion for PAPN, Podcast Ain't Played Nobody. And I believe, and I could be wrong, I apologize if so, I believe that this is a meeting of the only two national outlet writers who cover at a high level both college football and football with Tom Fornelli and Bill Connolly together. And as you mentioned before the show, who knows what might happen? We could end up trying to figure out when Koulibaly's coming back and what's wrong with Napoli as we start to get into the back half of the Serie A season.
I'm going to be really disappointed if we don't.
How have you been doing?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
We're good. We're good. Now, the your returning production post, it's something that the listeners here on the Cover 3 Podcast, especially during the Hurry Up Hot Seat, heard a lot of, because we didn't have spring practice to be able to give us new notes and information, which meant we had to rely on a lot of hard data. And so, we've talked about your returning production percentages, and it's good to have you on here to describe them. You've just crunched the numbers for the upcoming season. Was it one of the biggest headaches that you've ever had trying to obtain? Because a lot of it is information gathering, and information gathering with the fluidity of the transfer portal, the super seniors. There's a lot of different things that have to be taken into consideration for this.
Yeah, and to be honest, I punted on one of the biggest headaches, which is what the hell do you do with UConn, New Mexico State, and Old Dominion?
No
who
football.
Technically, they return infinity production from 2020. So that was a big. I got some ideas for that. And obviously, that's probably not the most high stakes part. You know, getting Old Dominion right probably isn't as important as getting other teams right. But I mean, in the end, I just kind of went with what I typically do. I did have to kind of scale things to basically convince my spreadsheets that everybody played 12 games, just kind of scale it all to 12 games. So, Washington State had to be tripled and whatnot. But I mean, the process otherwise was approximately the same. It was just more, more of a lot of stuff, more transfer portal stuff. I tried to get as many of the schools listed the lists of who's returning, which super seniors are returning from each team and all that. And then we'll see what happens when the actual rosters come out here in a little bit. But I mean, yeah, it wasn't that much different since I punted on the three big headaches.
Is there any part of you that's worried about the validity of your rankings, considering you're leaving out the defending New York Times champion UConn Huskies?
Well, all I want out of this, by the way, this isn't exactly an answer to the question, but all I want is New Mexico State to go 3-0 against D2 teams and claim a national title. That's really that's the only thing I hope to get out of this spring experiment is the unbeaten New Mexico State saying we want Bama, because guess who they get in the fall?
Bama.
It'd be a long-awaited matchup of national champions.
So, Bill, I know the answer to this, but for our audience at home, why returning production as opposed to just returning starters, right? Like I'm 35 for 20 years of my life. I would just take a look and say, okay, how many starters they have come back? All right, cool. And it's still like an easy soundbite. Why is returning production, you know, percentage? Why is that a better metric?
Well, we know we use returning starters, or we have forever, because it's the only thing we have, right? I mean, we know it kind of stinks. We know all the limitations from it, how, you know, number one, quarterbacks are a little more important than other positions. And, you know, that part of it, plus, you know, if you have a platoon, if you have two running backs, one of them leaves and it's not a returning starter, the other one leaves and it is a returning starter, but they were the same. And so we kind of inherently knew that what we were getting at was some sort of returning production thing. But that wasn't, we didn't have the access for it. So, once I've been, collecting data for a while and running all my, you know, preview spreadsheets and all that stuff, I kind of realized like I could technically dump this all together and start, you know, playing with trying to figure out what actually matters. You know, if you return X percent of your passing yardage, how much of an impact does that have on next season, and versus percentage of your rushing yards versus percentage of defensive back tackles versus all these other things. I just started tinkering. And so every year at the end of the year with another year of data, I tinker some more. And I think it basically just, it gets at what we thought we were getting from returning starters anyway. It just does hopefully a better job of it.
So what matters? Like, what are the, I mean, I know you've got the percentages in your post, but like, as you've tried to figure out what matters, I mean, that sounds like it could be a very revealing thing about football and the way that it's played right now in college football.
Yeah. I mean, from the start, like every year, the percentages change a little bit. Now that I have good offensive line data, or better offensive line data than just like how many starts from last year or how many career starts return and lost. Now that I have like snap count data, it turns out that matters a lot more than I was able to make it matter in previous years. But generally, I mean, obviously passing yardage matters a lot. Returning production at the quarterback position is still end all be all compared to everything else. But it appears that, you know, your overall percentage of returning production in the receiving core matters more than running backs, for instance. On the defensive side of the ball, what you return at defensive back tends to matter more than linebacker or defensive line. So that kind of tells us some general picture of, you know, continuity in the passing game seems to matter quite a bit. Like I said, now that I have good offensive line data, it turns out that does matter a decent amount. And you can kind of divide out, you know, if we look at the percentages by, it's like 29% passing yards, 5% rushing yards, 34% receiving yards, 33% old line snaps on offense. You divide that out like per player, and it's like 5 to 7% for everybody that isn't a quarterback, and then 29% for quarterbacks. And I think that's intuitive. I think that kind of would be sort of what we would guess at the end of the day.
You mentioned how you tinker with it every year a little bit. You mentioned just now like what's more important, but how has that changed in recent years? Because I know when I would do my own kind of preparations for, you know, whatever rankings, or just trying to figure out how good a team's going to be preseason wise. When it came down to returning starters on offense, the only things I really cared about used to just be, is the quarterback back and how much the offensive line is back? When it came to like skill positions like running backs and receivers, I was more interested in not how much experience you had as much as the talent level of, you know, your recruits and the guys that you had. And on the defensive side, I cared more about like your front seven. But in recent years, like you kind of just mentioned, I think it's becoming more and more important for on the defensive side to secondary experience back there is key, as we've seen, you know, the offensive explosion across the country. And you mentioned that, you know, wide receivers are more important than running backs these days when it comes to trying to figure out production. But how is that trend gone? Like, is receivers from what you've seen always been more important, or is that gap widening? And the same thing with the secondary, is the gap widening between them and the front seven from just from what you're seeing?
With the receiving, it's always been there. You know, and I think with, on the defensive side, it's been, I think it's evened out a little bit. I think when I first started running projections, especially when I didn't have good O-line data, so they were only like 10% of the offensive equation, it was quarterback, receiving core, DBs way ahead of everybody else. Mm-hmm. O-line evened that up on the offensive side of the ball. But I think just, in general, it kind of feels like, I'm trying to remember now. I think the linebackers, as I get more data, the linebackers tend to be have become a little bit more valuable, but it's still the least valuable unit overall. And then defensive line it becomes a little bit less. But no, it has been, the percentages have changed a little bit, but the overall concept has been passing game, passing game, passing game overall.
So, Bill, I'm scanning your article on ESPN. We have more than 25 teams that return 80% of their production. I've got to think that I don't have last year's in front of me, but A, that intuitively seems like a lot. And B, if it is a lot, how much of that is related to the fact that we get these kind of bonus year COVID super seniors? We don't have an official term for this, by the way. I had to write a piece on that today, and it was like, what do I call these guys? Like COVID bonus year seniors?
Seem to be jumping on super seniors.
Okay, super
seniors. Because it sounds good.
It does.
Yeah, super a COVID senior, you don't want to be associated with the virus as like your whole presence is. That's the reason. I totally understand. Super seniors, I can rock with that.
Sounds like a Marvel character, so it works
better. That's right. So, I mean, as far as I know, it's mostly because of the quote unquote super seniors, but basically, you know, looking at previous years of data, it tended to be like 61 to 63% national average, 61 to 63%. And then you'd have, you know, 6 to 10 teams, I guess 80% or higher. This year, the average is, while acknowledging that I don't have all the G5 rosters figured out yet, because that data or that information has been harder to come by. It's at like 69.5%. So we're at least at 6-7% higher than normal. And that's without complete data. So it might end up being 70 or 71%, almost 10 percentage points higher than normal. So, I mean, there's been a lot of transfer movement. Maybe I'm doing a better job of accounting for some of that, because I do kind of, when you get a transfer in, I just kind of mash his stats into your overall team stats. That's been the best approach I've found so far. So there might be a little of that, but I think it is that a lot of schools are bringing back a lot of seniors, more than I really anticipated, honestly. Because nobody's returning everybody, but they're finding space for these guys. And that does make a huge difference. You look at a team like Ole Miss is at 81% and they're 22nd. They would have been top 10 any other year in this ranking, but they're barely top 25 because so many other teams. I got yelled at for some of the teams on the list. Like, I can't believe Wake Forest isn't higher. I can't believe Indiana's not higher. It's like, well, they're high. It's just everybody else is too, and it makes it really interesting when you scroll down and you look at the teams that don't have a lot of returning production, and it's going to cost them even more than normal. BYU at 31%. That's kind of scary when they're playing a bunch of Pac-12 teams, especially, and the Pac-12 returns like freaking everybody this year. But Northwestern losing a ton is going to hurt. Maybe Notre Dame, South Carolina, Tennessee, some of those teams where they would always be projected to regress because of that. Now they're really going to be projected to regress because so many other teams are going to have so much experience.
Yeah, like I made the comment, I think we talked about it on Twitter earlier a couple of weeks ago too, but it's, if you go through like individual school message boards at 24/7 sports right now, there are a lot of fan bases who are telling themselves, hey, look at all these guys we got coming back next year. We're gonna make a run next year. It's gonna be an up season. And like, just using my own personal, like I reading the Illinois board with Bert Bielema's first season, you know, at Illinois, they've got all these players coming back, and I'm reading it, and all the fans are sitting there like, oh man, we're gonna surprise people next year. Bielema's coming in. We got a new coaching staff. We got a veteran team, and they all think that they've got all this returning experience. Then I look at your rankings. Illinois ranked 62nd. as far as returning production. And they're at 70%, which is well above the typical average that you would see like on a regular season. But again, with all the players across the country returning back because of the COVID and the waiver, you know, it's ridiculous how it's going to be next year. And it's like, that's one of the things that I've had like headaches trying to figure out going into next year when I'm trying to do all this stuff and rank teams and figure things out. It's like, I don't know who's it's so much more confusing because there are so many players coming back.
Yeah. Missouri's in the same boat. The boards are very excited because they did get some of their seniors back and all that stuff. And they're 56th in returning production. So you're pretty much treading water if you only bring back a high amount of your production. So, I mean, it's good for college football, I guess. It means there's going to be more experience and quality in the sport overall. And I haven't even been able to factor in the most of the opt-outs from last year, because since a lot of them have landed in the portal, I've been kind of waiting to see, you know, let's make sure they show up on spring rosters and then I'll add them then. But it's going to be great for college football, but a lot of fan bases are going to be disappointed because only one team can win a given game. And that's going to make things, I hope it's a good thing. I hope it turns out to be just more competitive games, more quality and all that. But yeah, I mean, a lot of teams that think they're going to surprise probably aren't going to.
Going to be a lot of veteran players going out losing games.
Yes. Yeah. So having that emotional senior night moment where you realize the season didn't really turn out like you wanted it to.
Do you have an idea this season, at least, where the – I guess I hope I don't mess this up for all my stat heads out there, but like where the standard deviations are, or at least like where the tiers are, like what – You mentioned that right now the average is a nice 69.5, and you go and you look, and you know, certainly that would be around like your Clemson at 65, Michigan State, right. You know, Illinois at 70, at 62. But like where on either end of the spectrum, either the high ranking or the low ranking, do you start to draw the line and say that is, you know, more middle of the pack and that is definitive? That's a lot of production coming back, or a little amount of production coming back.
Yeah, there will be a lot of middle of the pack. The middle of the pack is going to be really big. Right. But without giving away, like I'm still watching the transfer portal right up until the moment we actually post the SP Plus projections this week. But I can say that, you know, BYU was a legitimate top 10 team in SP Plus this year. They're falling off the map in the projections. And then on the other side, the teams that are like 90%, there are three teams over 90%. usually number one's at like 86, 88, but you've got Louisiana. I almost said Louisiana Lafayette. I'm trying to be better about that. But Louisiana at 96% returning production, like almost literally everybody returns. And part of that is because, I mean, they lost two good running backs, but running backs don't matter as much in this formula, but they return almost everybody else besides that. Then you got 91% for UCLA, 91% for Miami. I'll just say that when you see the rankings, UCLA and Miami are going to be a lot higher than you expected. And it's just because like that is so extreme. It's so extreme a total, even though everybody, you know, there is a big middle of the pack there. Those teams on the extremes are really, really up there.
All right, Bill, before we jump into, you know, the more specific teams here, how nervous are you that of the elements of your formula, right? You have your, you know, production over a certain number of years, right? Still five, I assume, five-year weighted average.
Yeah. I mean, it's primarily last year with an adjustment for returning production, but there's still a little bit of that year two through five in there. Yeah.
And then you obviously have the recruiting element and, you know, returning production element.
Yeah.
Last year was weird.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, you got some teams that just roster wise probably shouldn't have been the 50th best team in the country. And some of your performance was based on like, how healthy were you? Did you, how often did you have to sit guys out for contact tracing? Did your team ever get to practice together at full strength during the season? If you're the Pac-12, did you play more than four games?
Right.
Right. Like, does it worry you at all from a projection standpoint? Not that you really have an alternative here, because
right,
the season is what it was, but I mean, this is going to weight UCLA fairly heavily.
Yeah.
And they played a Pac-12 schedule, which is probably the wonkiest of all the P5 leagues.
Yeah, I mean, most of when they're projected to improve this year, I mean, they were barely a top 50 team. So it's not like, you know, they overachieved on a tiny sample, they improved. But I'm not necessarily The sample is definitely going to make things weird. There's no question about that. When I look at the rankings that, you know, that will go up, I mean, most of it makes sense. You know, the top three, four teams are exactly who you think they're going to be. And of course, Georgia's top 10. Of course, Iowa State's top 10 with all they return. So there aren't that many surprises. And that's what I was kind of watching for. Like when I knock all this out, is it going to be, am I going to have Washington State like 12th all of a sudden because everybody in the Pac-12 returns everybody? And I don't. I do, as if you saw that tweet the other day, like the average projected SP Plus rating for a Pac-12 team is higher than the SEC at the moment, which kind of freaks me out a little bit. But when I look at the distribution, it's basically because they have a bunch of like top 15 to 30 potential teams, and SEC still has South Carolina and Vanderbilt. That's why the ranking or the averages are what they are. The top SEC teams are still higher, so I'm not that worried about that. But no, it's going to be weird. All I know is, though, every time I tried to adjust for oddity in the fall, I made my numbers worse. So I'm just trying to just like the boat is out there sailing right now. I'm trying to just, you know, keep with the kind of the known methods of projection and whatnot as much as humanly possible, because I don't make things better when I start to just guess how things are going to go. That doesn't ever work.
Was that
if you're trying to hit a clause in your contract for a minimum number of Feinbaum appearances, tweeting out the Pac-12 team average rating is higher than the SEC. Like you, Bill, you're going to lock that up early this year, man. That is guaranteed booking.
Paul remembered me after I went on after, you know, the bowl projections or the bowl pairings were announced, and I said the SEC was overrated. The next time I went on, he remembered the outcry that I dealt with for that. So, you know, it's all about making people remember you.
Do you think that the all boats will rise in the Pac-12? Because the Pac-12 got a lot of players that are taking advantage of the super senior opportunity.
Yep.
And you mentioned that within the context of, you know, your rankings, there's going to be some extrapolation from the small Pac-12 to try and make it line up. But do you look at the Pac-12 as an analyst? Do you look at the Pac-12 and do you see like some exciting, good football, some teams that you can get behind right now?
I do. As long as we're not talking about national title contenders, I absolutely do. There is at most one. I mean, Oregon, if you really wanted to talk me into Oregon being a national title contender, like I'll listen. I don't completely believe it. And I will admit that SP Plus is a little higher on them than I am. But otherwise, I mean, you're just talking about like everything I saw from Arizona State last year with their incredible run game that kind of came out of nowhere with two running backs I hadn't heard of before the season started. Like that feels like an absolute top 25 potential team to me. Utah, of course, is. Washington is. USC, this is the other thing. SP Plus does not have USC as high as like the preseason top 10, way too early kind of rankings. That makes me feel good too. It's telling you to tap the brakes on USC while still liking the Pac-12. So kind of passes that test. It is pretty aggressive on UCLA. Which I mean, they absolutely looked better last year, yes. But I mean, you can still, you know, you don't have to believe in UCLA if you don't want to, but overall it did make sense. All the teams that are really high or higher than normal, I think it makes sense to me, especially with the experience levels, with Washington likely being, I mean, they were good last year from the minute that we saw them, and I think they'll be pretty good still. I think this is going to be, as far as Pac-12 goes, I think this is going to be a very good year for them. I just don't see a national title contender.
Coming up on the other side, the teams that stand out, trying to look for some context and maybe even some explanations behind the way things broke down with Bill Connolly next.
Support for this podcast comes from Progressive. What would you do with an extra $800? Buy a plane ticket? Pay down your student loan? Treat yourself to those shoes you've been eyeing. With Progressive, you could find out. Drivers who switch and save an average of $796 on car insurance. Get your quote online at progressive.com and see how much you could be saving. National average annual car insurance savings by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive in 2019.
Support for this podcast comes from McDonald's. What does a Sprite from McDonald's taste like? Many say it's electrifying. Others believe that refreshing first sip is the best part. But don't take our word for it. Let your taste buds make their own assessment. Get any size soft drink for only a dollar on the McDonald's $1, $2, $3 menu.
Go ahead, try a spicy Sprite or enjoy a Coke, Diet Coke, Fanta, or Dr. Pepper. Prices and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any offer or combo meal.
So are you, again, just sort of, you've got your numbers to be able to help inform you, but you also get to make some opinions based on the football that you watch, people that you talk to. What is the ceiling for you driving Iowa State hype next season? Like, are you going to take this all the way to making a college football playoff prediction? Will you dare call them like the anti blue chip foil that's here for the national championship conversation? Sort of, where's your floor and ceiling for your Iowa State expectations and preseason prognostication?
Well, I do. There's nothing I love better than hedging. So I don't want to get too carried away in the fact that OU projects incredibly well too, allows me to, tap the brakes on Iowa State at least a little bit. But Bud and I have talked about this before. If there's ever going to be the kind of the blue chip ratio breaker, so to speak, the team that it doesn't pass the recruiting hurdle and still really, really contend for a national title, it's going to be a team that has a very good, very well-established quarterback.
Check.
At least one true all-American caliber skill guy.
Check.
You're preferably a receiver, I think, but running back in Iowa State's case, I think that certainly suffices. And then you need an absolute ace pass rusher. You're still going to need the depth and good talent evaluation, and you're going to need to avoid injuries and all those other things. And you're still going to need to get a little bit lucky. But if you have those three things, that's going to get you pretty far down the road. And so, I mean, this year especially, I mean, they are by far the best candidate to be the national title contender that barely recruits better than Kansas on paper.
I can't wait to fade Iowa State next year. It's because like these returning production rankings, I get it. They were very good this year. Mostly everybody's back. They're going to be very good again. And I felt like this year was kind of a correction to a team that's record in the last few years hadn't been a good indicator of how good they actually were. And I feel like we saw the correction this season. But now, like, we see where they are in your returning production rankings. We're seeing kind of the hype.
Yeah.
But if you look at like title futures at sports books right now, like at William Hill, Iowa State's got the same odds to win the national title as Notre Dame and Florida, better odds than Texas, USC, LSU, even North Carolina. And then there are some books I saw where they've got, better odds than those teams. Like they have better odds than Florida and Notre Dame. And I'm sitting there thinking, listen, I really like Iowa State, guys, but let's slow it down a little bit. So I already know going into 2021, I will be on the full fade the Cyclones tour.
Well, the having better odds than Notre Dame doesn't really move me all that much because
Notre Dame's at the bottom of the returning production percentage.
Yeah. I mean, Notre Dame fans will tell you that my numbers hate them always anyway. So, whatever. But looking at Notre Dame's, this is a complete subject change, but looking at Notre Dame's the middle of their schedule, at Florida State, probably not as hard as maybe we thought it was going to be 5 years ago or something, but Wisconsin on neutral field, Cincinnati at home, at Virginia Tech, who, not great, but top 40 road game, USC and North Carolina in a 5-game stretch. That's rough. And so I would not be placing any money on Notre Dame to win to make the college football playoff or win the title next year.
Wisconsin also from a recruiting perspective, their best back-to-back year combined rating ever by far. Something to look up. I kind of wonder, so Bill, we talked about this offline some. Iowa State's recruiting ranking is going to drag their projection down.
Right.
And it should to some extent. Do we think of returning production maybe as not a guarantee, but as an indicator that says, hey, there's a pretty good chance they can continue to play to the level that they just played right at? But like, how much more of a leap can this Iowa State team actually take given their talent level?
Yeah, I mean, if I get everything set up that I would ever want to get set up here in the coming years, one of the things is being able to kind of weight the recruiting piece of the projections overall accordingly with how much returning production you have. Cause the whole idea of the recruiting piece is like, okay, you're learning that you're losing this much production. What caliber of athlete are you replacing it with? So UCLA and Iowa State of Louisiana doesn't necessarily matter this next year, how they recruit, because we already know what their starting lineup's going to be. So that would be great. And meanwhile, with like a BYU or a Tennessee or something, you got to fill in a lot more spots with recruits. How good are those recruits? Maybe that matters more. But at the same time, I kind of look at the recruiting piece as just a general like depth evaluator. And from that perspective, I don't necessarily mind that I am counting every team's recruiting rankings the same. And it really doesn't drag Iowa State down that much. Like if it was only returning production in last year's numbers, they'd be like third in the projections this coming year. And that'd be insane. But the recruiting piece drags them down to like lower half of the top 10. And that kind of, that hits my eyeballs, right? Like, I think that makes sense to me. So I don't mind it staying that way.
So some ACC questions. I'll lump these three together, right?
Okay.
And we already did Notre Dame. They're not in the conference anymore. Your running back projection, 5% of the total, is going to be put to the test here with North Carolina.
Yes,
they returned 79% of their overall production, despite the fact they lost, you know, Carter
4,000 yards of total offense between a couple guys.
This is a big test, Bill.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't mind. Like they did run the ball a lot. They had almost 300 carries between them in whatever, 11, 12 games. So, I mean, they certainly leaned on that a little bit. And Ty Chandler's good, but he's not, I mean, unless he's just better in that system, he isn't going to fill in all that production. So yeah, that is a piece of it, but it's going to hurt them a lot more to lose those receivers. The reason they're as high as they are is they get back Howell and like the entire offensive line. That's why they end up being as high as they, like if the offensive line didn't count as much, like if it was like the old formulas where I didn't have the right data, then they'd get hit pretty hard by the fact that they lose Brown and Newsome, and then like the, you know, the running backs as well, I guess. So yeah, that's going to be, they have a lot of replenishing to do on the skill core, and I really like, you know, the little glimpses that we saw of some of their younger players, but I mean it was only glimpses, and that's a really hard high bar to clear, because they are going to be projected pretty high.
I'm definitely hanging way too much on like a few good runs by British Brooks against Texas A&M's defense in the Orange Bowl, where I was like, hey, whatever. Like, who even needs Ty Chandler here? We got this in-state guy who's just ready to come in and roll. And like you said, maybe that's just the system, right? And not that Carter and Williams are not very, very special players in and of themselves, but once that offensive line, even this year, started playing together and sort of had really gelled as a cohesive five, I mean, you might be able to just cycle in a stable of backs, whoever's got fresh legs, hot hand, and still be able to put up decent numbers.
Right. I mean, yeah, returning Sam Howell and your entire offensive line is a pretty good starting point for an offense. Like, it wasn't the most amazing line in the world, I guess, but it was still solid enough to, you know, not get in Williams and Carter's way. And, you know, his Howell's sack rates weren't bad for how much he moves around. So, you know, I still think they're going to have a very good offense, but that will be a test as far as like what matters, line versus quarterback versus skill core. That skill core, who was the dude who had like the 80-yard touchdown catch against A&M? Whichever one of those young Downs.
Josh Downs.
So I mean, lots of great glimpses of those younger guys, but yeah, it's gonna be a big test to match that overall projection.
British Brooks is like a real year 12 of an NCAA football dynasty name.
With Britton Brown as well, coming back for year 12 at UCLA.
Who else did you have in the ACC on your list, bud?
Oh, yeah. So this is kind of got to be the year Jeff Collins takes a big step forward, right? And that number 13 overall in returning production. I mean, that division is not necessarily super winnable, but like you could see a path to them finishing second or third in the Coastal, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're top 50. The spoiler, they'll be about 50-ish in SP Plus. So they are projected to, they improved a little bit. They'll be projected to improve again because they were hilariously young in 2019 and somehow barely more experienced in 2020 with all the new recruits in there. So, yeah, I mean, if he's got, you figure, you know, if it's an extreme rebuild, it'll take you 4 or 5 years sometimes, but you figure if he's got a breakthrough in him, we're at least going to get a glimpse of it, a couple glimpses of it, at least this coming year. They start with like NIU and Kennesaw State, which of course, Kennesaw State, not a gimme necessarily. Hello, Jason Kirk. But, you know, after that, they still have Clemson. They still have North Carolina. They still have Georgia. It's still a pretty brutal schedule. And, you know, we'll see. Miami is on there. Notre Dame's on there. You know, it's still going to be really hard for them to put together a good year. But if they can at least win the semi-winnable games and get up to 5-7, maybe. Like, it's hard for me to predict more than that, but I think that's at least on the table.
So my last one out of the ACC is the team at number 3 in your returning production, Miami. I think we're better than their record at times last year, and then they had two losses that were, you know, really non-competitive. I guess would be the charitable way to put it. If they play to their potential, are they like win the ACC good, or like they need to play to their potential and have Clemson regress?
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly help if Clemson regressed. You know, obviously my numbers are going to like North Carolina too, so it's not necessarily a gimme that they're the favorite in the Coastal. But no, they didn't finish the year well. But the upside they showed was, you know, it seems sustainable. You still have De'Aaron King back, assuming he's 100%. Obviously, we'll see how that goes. But you get Harley and Pope back. You get your entire offensive line back. You lose pass rushers, but you always have pass rushers. So, I mean, it seems like whatever we saw from them last year, and they ended up 20th in SP Plus last year. They slipped. They slipped pretty well at the end of the year, but. Yeah, I mean, it seems like that's all pretty replicable. And, you know, if they can improve, if King's, you know, got a better rapport with his skill core, if the offensive line's better because it returns everybody. I mean, another spoiler, they're high in SP Plus. They're higher than I would prefer when you see the actual projections. But that kind of does seem like a top 15 team at the very least. And so usually that's good enough to win the Coastal, especially if it's overestimating what North Carolina has to offer.
See, that Clemson regression thing is really interesting because there's a little number for Clemson offensively, which certainly takes into consideration the loss of, you know, former ACC Player of the Year, two times over Travis Etienne, and ACC Player of the Year, Trevor Lawrence, generational talent at quarterback, number 118. But there's another number for Clemson, and it's on the defensive side of the ball, where Brent Venables has 92% returning production on the defensive side of the ball. Like, I don't know about Clemson regression. Like, it seems as though that 92% part of the equation, and again, overall, a very nice 69% right there at number 65 in the country, like smack dab in the middle of the data set. But that 92% feels like it provides a very, very, very high floor for like whatever happens with the reloaded offense without Trevor Lawrence.
Yeah, I mean, what you tend to see from these returning productions list is like, you know, Alabama always ranks low because of course they do. They always lose, you know, half their starters to the pros, and then the next guys are just as good.
Yeah, they're at 55%, I think. Yeah. Right? Yeah, 55% this year.
Yeah, and Ohio State's low. They're fine, you know. But Clemson, the fact that they are ranking in the middle of the pack in terms of returning production among the good teams, I think only Oklahoma. Well, I guess if we're counting Oregon, Oregon's up there too. But you know, Oklahoma kind of kills the returning production equation as well. But Clemson's as high as just about anybody in that elite list, and that's usually a good sign. Like Alabama was of course going to start out, but like, I mean, it's not even a spoiler to say that Alabama is going to start out first in SP Plus. They finished last year like 7 points ahead of everybody else in the country. So, you know, unless they lost every single starter, they were going to be number one to start the year. But I mean, you have to feel pretty good if you're Clemson about what you return, about, you know, if there's any sort of slowdown on offense with everything Alabama loses, you have to feel very good about where you are. And I mean, I guess Clemson's probably felt very good about where they are for a while. So I guess that's not really a change in any kind.
You mentioned Ohio State's ranking. I was going to ask you something too, what you thought, like just as far as the Big Ten, because if we look at your returning production ranks, the two teams that played in the Big Ten championship are in the bottom 10 as far as returning production, because Ohio State's at 121st with 50%. Northwestern, out of the 127 teams in the list, is 126th with 34%. And as you alluded to earlier, it's much different for Ohio State to replace 50% of its production than it is for Northwestern to replace 66. So I feel like Ohio State, like you kind of just said, they're probably going to be fine, but you think it's pretty fair to say that Northwestern probably not going to win the West next year, particularly when you look back towards the top of the rankings and you see Wisconsin's up there, you see Minnesota's up there.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the margins are always small for Northwestern. They kind of plan it that way. You know, we're going to keep things very We're going to force, we're not going to allow you to ever score a touchdown, where you're only going to kick field goals. We're going to have like three good drives, but it's going to be enough to keep us in the game. Like, the formula is going to remain the same, and that's good. But we saw 2 years ago what happens if you don't kind of clear a certain bar offensively. And that's where a lot of their lost production is. I mean, this is pretty familiar territory, but the SP plus projections themselves are going to have them in the teens again on defense and in the 120s again on offense because of how much they lose. And so, you know, they know that territory. They know how to win games with no offense whatsoever. But you do figure it's going to be hard when you look at what Wisconsin brings back. Minnesota's defense, it was bad enough last year to give me pause on them overall, even though I think I like what they have offensively. But, I mean, they're going to be experienced. Iowa's experienced. Nebraska is at least experienced. I can't decide what I think they're going to be. But – yeah, like you still need to clear a certain bar offensively, and it's really hard to think that Northwestern's going to clear it.
I'm super excited for the Wildcats to start out really poorly and for us to get like plus 17, plus 20, plus 16 within down the stretch, because that is just going to be a Pat Fitzgerald ATM.
Their schedule could be kind of false hope, by the way, because they start with Michigan State and Indiana State, Duke, Ohio, which, I mean, isn't a gimme, I guess, but wherever their wins are, they're at the start of the schedule. So that might be kind of tough. Like, they might be, you might not get too many points on them for like the Minnesota and Iowa games. We'll see.
It was a few years ago that you released Study Hall, a book, a very good book, which football fans can pick up. And in that, I know there were a lot of conversations with coaches, and I imagine that some of those conversations have continued as we're here in 2021. What is your sense of the coaching community, the different analytics that they're willing to embrace? What seems to matter to them in college football right now? Have you seen a change over the past couple of years, and sort of what's your sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, there are more companies out there, and more of them are getting paid by schools to provide, whether it's fourth down decision making, whether it's whatever. Like, it's definitely made inroads. I don't know what the effects really are. I mean, I know teams are going for more on fourth down. I think developmentally, there's been a lot of really interesting. That's kind of my white whale, is figuring out a fun way to write about development. It's I haven't figured it out yet.
Like, but player development, like how players get better.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, just all the catapult stuff, you know, just being able to track things that they couldn't track before, or at least track them better. Those services are out there. It's hard to tell who, besides Army, I guess, is really using them, who just pays for them to have them available to them, and then, you know, freak out and punt on fourth and two at the last second. But just the availability of data from a writing standpoint, like, I don't think I've ever actually read Study Hall after I wrote it, but like, I think it would kind of freak me out to go back and, like, just a lot has changed in terms of what's available to writers, what's available to coaches. It does feel like there's been a lot of progress. It's just, you never, seeing it on the field is like the last step, because it really does, when you're on the field, when you're making in-game decisions, you still lean on your instincts, and those are the last thing to change.
What's the catapult stuff? Is that the player tracker?
Yeah, the GPS stuff, the you know, just being able to monitor heart rate and sleep patterns and whatever else. That's not just catapult, but just going down that road of monitoring all that stuff, all the stuff that's creating lots of privacy concerns at the moment in terms of what we should be tracking and all that. But yeah, that's certainly gone a long way in the last 5, 6, 7 years.
All right, Bill, we're going to do an episode on this coming up. What is the one rule that you would change, either on the field, off the field, it's simply regulation, whatever? Is there one rule in college football that really bugs you, that you think either is unfair or makes the game not as exciting or not as enjoyable as it could be? What would you do if you had one shot at it?
I'm going to tick you off. The one thing I would change is actually something that everybody else wants to change, and I wouldn't, and that is keep the damn 3-yard ineligible receiver. No. Let those RPOs get a little wilder at the college level. That's, you know, that seems to be lot of people don't. Most people don't think that, and I'm refusing to budge. I want my football as offense friendly as possible. So that's a non-change that I would like.
All right. Well, this was a good interview. Thanks for coming on, Bill.
And meanwhile, honestly, you said college, but the first answer that popped into my head was yesterday was the Super Bowl, and it was a nice reminder of how the spot foul pass interference at the pro level is the most ridiculously punitive and unbelievably stupid penalty in the game of football at any level. Like somehow, like if you accidentally trip a guy on a long bomb, it's worse than a face mask or a targeting, three times worse even. But anyway, like that's I'm pretty like, I guess since I've answered two things that weren't actually answers, I don't know. I mean, I obviously the targeting area is one that we're still trying to figure out. And I love Bud's idea of like the flagrant one, flagrant two. I know a lot of people have come up with that actually. Like being able to kind of discern now as we go along, like you don't have to, this was clearly accidental. We don't have to eject you for this. That seems like a pretty logical step. I don't know why we took that away from the face mask penalty. Bringing that back would be lovely too. But that seems to be one area where I don't really know why we haven't made more progress in that regard.
See, my only concern with that, and like, I think logically it's the smart way to go, but my concern is now you're making the ref make another decision. Like, you know what I mean? Like, well, each ref is going to have a different definition of what was excessive and what wasn't. And that's going to lead to just more anger.
And if we were interpreting it consistently as is, I would agree and say, like, wait, let's not add complication. But it's like it's like between that and catches, I never really I watched the replay and I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I think it was a catch. I don't know what the ref's going to say. So, yeah, I mean, since it's so inconsistent anyway, why not add more complication to it?
What would happen to Twitter stock if we knew what targeting was? They'd probably wow.
this is all a deep ploy by Twitter to make sure it's as confusing as possible, that and what a catch is in the NFL. Now, I'd be cool with, leaving the 3 yards as is, but only when we have teams that have averaged a top 25 recruiting class over a 5-year period. Like, we can't let these 6'5", 330-pound offensive linemen come blast your under-recruited, overdeveloped 3-star safety to just, like, open things up in the middle of the field and turn an easy pass into a touchdown.
Well, and honestly, my biggest problem with that rule in general is like, we don't have a ref stationed 3 yards downfield. Right. Like that's, it becomes impossible to actually interpret because you're not lined up right for it. But again, I'm all for offense still, especially since defenses are, I think, making a little bit of progress with the non-Alabamas of the world. We need to make sure we still have our random shootouts.
I just worry that teams will start doing what Arkansas does, right? Which is we're just going to drop 8 every play to these teams that are so RPO and pass heavy and okay, but like then you don't give up any explosive plays and the game becomes just a million 6-yard passes. Not to that extreme, obviously.
Like Leach is getting excited.
Yeah, right. Now, what if we made it reviewable or more punitive? And instead of just like instead of replay the down, what if you lose the down? 10 yards and you lose the down. We'll keep the 3 yards, but if you actually exceed it, if you're blocking my safety who's in the box at 6 yards depth, then let's have you lose the down. I don't know. Just I do like offense.
That does remind me of another one I would like to change. The offensive pass interference, where it's like a pick and it's basically an illegal block, but it's 15 yards. That one frustrates me a little bit because that's another one where like now it's first and 25 drives over. And it was just like, it was a minor, it was an illegal block. It was a 5 or 10 yard penalty, not first and 25.
The old, the fights break out over what to call it in the coach's room of the national championship game where half the room calls it a pick play. They call it a rub route on the other side of the table. Yeah. 100%. All right. So when are the SP plus new rankings come out? We're recording here on Monday afternoon. Sounds like it's coming this week. When should the people keep their eyes out for it?
Not sure. I think tomorrow. I'm pretty sure tomorrow. I think we were still trying to figure out the best like placement for it in the schedule. But I think Tuesday. We'll see.
You see Chip almost through the end in there?
Yeah, caught himself.
Mm-hmm. I'm like the only one who hasn't had a problem with that.
They're your rankings. You figured it out first.
Like, it was an immediate change. Maybe it was the fear involved. Like, I can't ever say the ampersand. Like, I'll get in trouble. So
no, we didn't get cease and desist letters. So like, it takes us a little bit longer.
Right. Like, so like for me, like there, it was pretty easy, but I guess for others.
SP plus, SP plus, SP plus, SP plus, and you can find them.
Splus.
Yes. Yeah, you can find the new Splus rankings on ESPN.com. You can follow him on Twitter at ESPN_BillC. You can follow him at BudElliott3. You can follow him at Tom Fornelli. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Follow us on Spotify. You can follow us on Spotify. You can hit our Spotify numbers for the month.
Follow and stream on Spotify. Thank you very much.
Or else.
I'm Luke Thomas, along with my co-host, Brian Campbell. Morning Combat brings you an entertaining and informative look at MMA and boxing.
Near, far, wherever the hell you are, Morning Combat will go on.
Khabib Nurmagomedov, I don't think he had peaked. I think he probably still has some levels he could get to.
Conor serious again about getting back into title contention.
CBS Sports became 1-1 with Bellator MMA. Showtime Boxing is poised to have a huge year. It's going to be insane.
Morning Combat with a K.
Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on all podcast platforms.
Rise and shine, football fans. This is Susanna Fuller from Morning Footy, a podcast part of the CBS Sports Galazzo Network covering the breadth of the global game. Join me, Nico Cantor, Charlie Davies, Alexis Guerreros, and guests every morning for the perfect blend of news, analysis, conversation, and exclusive interviews. If you love soccer, then look no further. We've got you covered for Europe's top five leagues, the W Gold Cup, the Champions League knockout stage, CONCACAF Nations League, NWSL, MLS, transfer news, and much more. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere podcasts are found. Subscribe to Morning Footy.